This October, the most important week in bluegrass returns to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Be part of IBMA World of Bluegrass October 20th through the 24th for 5 unforgettable days of live music, networking, and family fun. Join thousands of bluegrass artists and fans for the IBMA Business Conference, IBMA Bluegrass Ramble, IBMA Bluegrass Music Awards, and IBMA Bluegrass Live Festival. Get your tickets, see the lineup, and start planning your week at worldofbluegrass.org.
Hi, everyone. It's Tom Power. I'm back with a brand new and very special episode of Toy Heart, my podcast about bluegrass. It is an exclusive conversation with none other than Billy Strings that we recorded at last year's International Bluegrass Music Association Conference. If you love bluegrass as much as we do, and I assume you do, then this episode is certainly for you. Download and listen to this and all episodes of Toy Heart on the BGS Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. I'm Cindy Howes. This is Basic Folk, episode 350. What an accomplishment. Congratulations to us all for making it this far into the process. I want to thank my co-host and work wife, Lizzie No, the bluegrass situation, Shelby Williamson, Amy Reitnauer Jacobs, and the rest of the crew for being so supportive. It's just been incredible where this podcast has taken us and the great conversations that we've had. We're so thrilled to welcome Keb Moe on the show today for episode 350. Before we get into that, I want to encourage you to sign up for Basic Folk's mailing list. It's a once a month email that tells you who's coming up on Basic Folk, who's been on recently. You can also follow us on social media, Instagram mostly. Also on Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok at Basic Folk Pod. We're a listener-supported podcast, and you can make a contribution by going to basicfolk.com/donate. And all of those links are in the show notes. Okay, we were so honored to welcome Keb Moe, a.k.a. Kevin Moore, on the show for our 350th episode. After many decades of incredible music, his new solo acoustic album, The Breakdown, was written and recorded at his home studio near Nashville following open-heart surgery and personal life changes. He's also recently released his second collaborative album with the legendary Taj Mahal. Lizzie is currently in transition right now. She is moving to Ireland for grad school. So we were so lucky that Lizzie was able to talk to Keb Moe. I actually asked her to send me a voice memo of herself giving me notes about what the interview was like. And I thought that what she said was so perfect. I just wanted her to say it in her own words. So please excuse the quality of this recording because she was doing it when she was on the go. But what she's saying is really wonderful. Here's Lizzie No talking about her interview with Keb Moe.
I think we should highlight and maybe start the intro with Kevin's definition of the blues, which is honesty music. I think there's a lot of debate nowadays whether the blues is something that is like a formal set of requirements. Is it a genre? Is it a type of sound that's trapped in a particular historical era? And when I asked Kevin, like, what's your definition of the blues? He didn't even give the time of day to any of those nerdier, more gatekeepery explanations. He was like, if the music has that honesty and has the moan and the sense of like, I'm speaking to Black experience for a Black audience, for people who understand what it's like to struggle, that's what the blues is. He defines the blues as a feeling and an act of honesty. There's a spectrum of humility to ego in music, and there are artists for whom music and the act of performing is a vehicle for their own notoriety. And during our interview, I was struck by how far on the opposite end of the spectrum Keb Moe falls. Like from the very early days of childhood when he was learning the guitar for the first time, and just like even before he started playing his own music, like his first impressions of hearing music, it was all about learning and being in awe of players who he greatly respected and being humble before this tradition that he wanted to be part of. Kevin went from being a kid growing up in Compton and asking his parents for a guitar and like just knowing how much $25 meant in those days, like that was the cost of his first guitar, to now being an artist who's sponsored by so many guitar companies, and he's someone that people would love to have him play their guitars. Like, he still knows the value of an instrument and how like one guitar is more than enough. And he still remembers a time when the idea of having a collection of guitars was kind of crazy talk. I think one of the big points that I'd love to communicate in the intro is just the humility and the awe that he has always approached music with. Like, when we got to the end of our interview, I asked Kevin, like, what does success mean to you? And do you think you've achieved it? And his answer was, I get to keep playing and I don't have to get a regular job. Like, to him, it's still, even after all these years, so many accolades, it's a privilege to be a part of this tradition and to get to go play in front of people, play his own original music in front of people. I just want to shout out how generous Kevin is as a conversation partner. I came into this interview nervous because he's one of the more legendary guests that we've had on the show. And I found myself a number of times having to sit back and receive a compliment. Like, he's the first to be like, that was a great question. You're really thoughtful. You're killing it. So I was really lucky to interview him.
Let's take a listen to a clip from Keb's new album. This is Fussing and Fighting. And then we'll get to our conversation with Keb Moe and Lizzie No on Basic Folk. Hey, that rhymes.
A long time ago, when we first met, we were like children. I'll never forget, I was your main squeeze. We couldn't get enough, we were easy to please. We had everything, but something's changed. And I can't do nothing right. We spend every hour, every day and every night fussing and fighting. Driving me crazy. Where is the love we used to know from a long time ago? This fussing and fighting, it ain't gonna faze me. Baby, I love you more than you know. This fussing and fighting, is it ever gonna stop? I'm giving you everything, everything that I got. I'm waiting for the day you and I can get along, just like we used to when we were going strong. A star was shining so brightly on us, but lately it's been a little rough. But it's time that we had a transformation. Time to step away from a bad situation. This fussing and fighting is driving me crazy. Where is the love we used to know from a long time ago? This fussing and fighting, it ain't gonna faze me. Baby, I love you more than you know. This fussing and fighting, is it ever gonna stop? I'm giving you everything, everything that I got. Let's go back to the way it used to be. Let's have some fun.
Baby, let's not let Keb Moe, you are a legendary musician, creator, and champion of the blues and folk. Thank you so much for joining me on Basic Folk.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
I want to jump right in talking about the blues. You've been categorized as a blues artist from the very beginning of your career, even though your music encompasses a wide variety of genres, from jazz to folk to country and pop. So when you hear the phrase the blues, what does it mean to you? Is it a feeling? Is it a genre? Is it a style of playing? Like, what's your definition?
Truth. Realness. That's what the blues is. So I like to think that the blues defines and everything I do in some kind of way, that it has to be honest. When you say blues artists, it's just honesty artists, truth artists. You know?
That's a simple and good definition that I haven't heard before. I think a lot of people try to pin it down to a particular genre.
Yeah, well, we're kind of genre. We like to categorize things. I don't have a problem with being put in a category. I never have. That's the category you want to put me in. I'm not going to stay in it, but you can put me in it.
Yeah. How did you get introduced to Delta blues in particular?
Well, Delta blues was like, I was introduced to the blues as a child, basically. But as far as like really the Delta blues, that was in probably their 1991. Mm-hmm. Where when I heard the Delta blues, when I really heard it, I probably had heard it before, but hadn't paid much attention to it. But when I heard it, after being involved with the blues about for the last 5 years before that, all of a sudden I said, okay, that's the real stuff.
Yeah.
That's the truth. There was no screaming guitar through an amp. It was just some dude just got through off day work, off his work day, playing some music, singing a song, and getting that moan going, that old Southern moan that was in things, you know. It was like, so I looked at that as like, oh, that's honest, and that's what I have to be. I have to be honest like that.
Have you seen the audience and like the appetite for the blues change over the course of your career since the 90s?
I've right now I've seen more artists show up, you know, more blues artists, especially young ones showing up. Mm-hmm. And embracing the genre. I don't really notice the audience because I try not to pay attention to what trends are. I just try to pay attention to what I'm doing and make sure that I'm doing what I'm, my intentions are pure and clear. And then all that stuff, the audience and whatever they're doing, you know, that's what they're doing. I can't control that.
Yeah, hopefully they show up.
Yeah, that's the reason, basically. So everything is about, you know, is it reading? Is it reading back to me when I'm recording, when I'm performing? You know, am I getting a, you know, am I connecting to myself, first of all? Do I believe it? Mm-hmm. You know? And is it, am I presenting it in a way that's pleasing to myself and to the audience and cohesive? So I pay attention to those things. I don't really pay attention to how, you know, I mean, of course I see it. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, say that I don't, but that's where my focus lies mostly.
Now, I want to ask another question about your origins as a performer. You've based aspects of your performer identity on the short stories of Zora Neale Hurston. Can you tell the basic folk audience about Guitar Man? Like, who is he in the stories and who is he on stage?
You're the first person that ever asked me that question ever.
Oh, wow. I love to hear that.
I have to go back and think about that, you know, because Guitar Man basically was a catalyst. The role of Guitar Man was to be a catalyst to get to where I am now, basically. You know, it was probably the beginning, one of the first things that I did. I didn't look at it as a character. I was just accompanying the actors, you know. I felt like I was a kind of like a Greek chorus, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, in the background doing things, and I was there to help push the story forward, as opposed to actually being a main character, who he was. But he was in there, but he was a presence of that feeling, of that blues, that, you know what I mean, that sound. He made the sound that in terms of musically, that the actors were making with their dialogue. You know? So, for the first time I worked with it, I wasn't the main Guitar Man. I was the understudy of Guitar Man. But I was in the production that George C. Wolfe was directing. So I got to go to all the meetings, the the technical rehearsals, all the things there, and he would comment on it. He would talk about it, stir the archetypes and the people and the characters, what they meant, and he would comment on it and just all what he was saying, like the three men on the porch, if you're familiar with it, you know, those guys, you know, I guess I felt like one of the three men on the porch.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just about that, man. I mean, you've seen those three men on the porch. They're in all cultures. Sometimes it's two men, sometimes it's four.
Yes.
And they sit out and they ain't got nothing better to do but watch everybody go by and, you know, and just comment. And sit and lie and just talk crap. You know? So
it's like the ongoing commentary as the action takes place down front. Mm-hmm. I think it's an important job, even if they can be tricky sometimes.
Yeah, but that role was, you know, thanks for that, asking that question. You're making me dig. Okay, come on, Dizzy.
No, I think it's really interesting because, you know, you're a solo performer and that's what people know you for. But you also have your origins, you know, on the stage and in literature and in being someone that like comments on things from the bird's eye view.
Yes.
And that's an important role to play.
I try to comment without taking an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what happened. This is what we're dealing with. What do you think? And people kind of, you know, I'm a uniter.
Yes, absolutely.
You know,
when did you first start to see yourself as a singer? Did you really like consciously work on your technique or did it come up as something that was like a side project to your guitar playing?
Singing was never the main deal. It was always playing the guitar and having my part being in the band. But and as far as what my definition was singing was a very high bar, which I heard, of course, in the Baptist church growing up.
Yes.
So I wasn't thinking about, you know, singing. I was going, if you can't do that, shut your mouth. Go sit down somewhere. Yeah. You know, that's, all this other stuff's not singing. But singing became a part of the tool I needed to tell the stories. So I had to muster up enough singing skill to tell the story, to push that forward. And what I found was that was enough. If you get the right melody, the right structure, and if you get it right and you mean it, and you went through all the words, and the words are displaying the emotion that you want to portray, that if you say the words and sing the melody, the story and the emotion is already in there, even if I don't feel it on the night. The story and the stuff is built into the song. So it, basically the song kind of sings itself sometimes.
There's a real humility there in letting the song do its work and letting your voice just be a vehicle for the bigger story.
Yeah, that's all I got. I can't do that other thing. When your voice becomes... Like I sent a video out to cover my friend, the Shirley Caesar thing. She was preaching and she was in front of the song and she was telling the story but the enhancement of the story was quite emotional and quite, that's like telling a story. But she's also delivering a message of attitude, culture. She's telling you all about the South, the field hollers, the gospel, where we've been as a people. She's telling you a whole lot of things that are unspoken, and everybody understands all those other things that are being said without being said. Even the way singers, like a gospel singer or an R&B singer, will moan a little bit before they start singing, just to let you know, you know?
Yeah.
You know? Okay.
Yeah, it starts with like a shared understanding of what we've been through. And like, that's just the starting point.
Yeah, it's fun. I love watching what people do and why it works and not trying to be anybody but myself.
It comes through in every single one of your recordings, I'll say that. I read an interview with you in Americana Highways where you were talking about your Oklahoma album, and the interviewer asked you about one of the songs, like the songwriting behind it, and you said it came into my space, which I thought was a really interesting kind of visual way of talking about inspiration and how it can show up in your life. So I'm wondering, like, what's your actual workspace like when it comes to writing songs? Like, do you have to put yourself in a particular headspace, sit at a desk? Like, how do you get yourself ready to receive inspiration?
What I do is open up to it. I feel like it's always there. It's like a big faucet running, and this creativity is just coming down out of the sky in droves. And I don't have to really have a special anything. If I just think it's raining songs out there. So you just have to be open and plugged in and get your mind out of the way. And sometimes if you're so clogged up at life and you can't hear it, you just start writing all the gibberish that comes out. And then pretty soon, like at some point, it starts making sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or
do you keep a journal for that purpose?
No, I'm pretty lazy.
I love that about you. For someone who's accomplished so much,
yeah.
You make it sound simpler than it is for a lot of us.
Well, because I'm kind of like unmotivated, I'm not motivated, but basically, you know, unmotivated to get out and really hustle and really like, I'm going to, you know, this. I think what I do is, I think whatever I manage to do has to count because I'm so lazy, you know.
Yeah.
It has to really, you know, it's got to go some kind of way. So then I spend a lot of time just honing my skills to observe and to listen. Like oftentimes, I'm actually a very unemotional person because I think when growing up, my mother was so emotional. I had three sisters and everybody was so emotional. I figured out a system how to shut down and just, you know, hear things. And of course, I'm a little scarred from it, you know. But I pause. I hear something and I don't immediately jump to conclusions. Like, I don't want to try to defend myself, I guess. I just want to understand what you're saying. And even if it's whether it's something that's a constructive attack on me or just someone sharing what they feel or just, you know, something I hear and I don't want to hear. And I just sit with it for a minute. And I don't talk that much really about my feelings. I have trouble setting boundaries, you know, in terms of what people can say to me and things like that, because I'll just listen to it and go, oh, okay. Let me think about that for a minute. You know.
That sounds like a blessing and a curse.
It is. And it's most of the time, I'm probably kind of misunderstood. You know, I can be perceived as uncaring. I'm not, you know. I don't know, some kind of things, you know, just numb. But I'm not numb. I have a coping mechanism that protects my little child heart from bursting and becoming, even though I'm almost 75 years old, you know, it's like,
yeah.
I'm still like trying to figure things out. But the song process is really fun. And I love the system I've used to kind of protect myself and to create from a standpoint of, you know, so it's just what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I find that relatable. I'm a songwriter as well. And I do think it comes from that childhood place of like the big people misunderstanding me and feeling like I couldn't say my feelings in conversation. And it's all kind of too much and overwhelming, but it it starts to make sense when you put it into verses. Like when mm-hmm. when it starts to rhyme and there's a melody attached, it's like mm-hmm. no one can tell you that's not true when you put it in a song. Mm-hmm. It all makes sense when it takes the form of music.
Yeah. I'm always surprised. Like yesterday, the day before, somewhere in the last couple of days, one of the songs from my new album got released, the one called One Day Away, you know. And
I'm going to start crying if I think about that song. It's so good. It's so deep.
I was like, hey, man, that one day, they were like, going, whoa. I was like, really? You know, because it's you know, and I wrote it with my friend Colin Linden, the same guy I wrote Life is Beautiful with. And Colin he's a Canadian, he's from Toronto, and he's one of these guys, real sensitive guy, and I met him a long time ago when he was playing with Bruce Coburn. And the two of us, when we write, something happens, you know, mm-hmm. and it happened again in that song, One Day Away. You know, just wait. Smile like wait. It's like, just like the titles, the working title should be just wait.
Yeah, it'll come. Let's get into your new album, The Breakdown. It's a really, really special body of work that strips away a number of things, like structures in your life, musical elements. It gets to the root of things. I want to start with Living in the Moment. Because according to what I've read about the album, this is a song that took a really long road from its inception to the final recording that we're hearing today. So can you talk about the original inspiration behind that song and kind of the journey that it took to get to this album?
Yeah, the song was written in the late 70s. Might have been the early 80s, probably the late 70s. Mm-hmm. You know, and with a writer named Andrea Weltman, you know, mm-hmm. and we would write songs. We had a lot of the songs we wrote and stuff. And that one my sister heard, you know, she heard it and she liked it. And she would always say, how can we never record Living in the Moment? You know, but, you know, I felt like I had evolved a long way away from that song, Living in the Moment. So I said, okay, I did it for her. To me, that's honest enough for me. And another friend of mine, he called me the day before yesterday. And he's called me. It's really a crazy call. He called me from his dying bed to tell me he was dying. And he wanted to hear that song too, you know. But it's like that song found its time. Mm. Not through me, but through other people, a couple other people who really it resonated with. So I put it on, and when I put it on, I found out that I had to tweak it a little bit, because in 1979, I wasn't as particular of a musician than I am now. I wasn't as attention to detail. I was always detailed, but not to the degree that I am now about things. Mm-hmm. So I went back in.
What are some of the details? I'm so curious musically, like what were some of the details that you felt like this has got to change before it is, you know, stamp of approval, ready to go?
Sometimes it's just where you put it on the guitar, where you play it, mm-hmm. what shapes you use, you know, what mm-hmm. key you do it in, the melody. Sometimes your melody is a step or a half step off from what it should be, you know, the real melody. And I go through and like not just lean on what I spontaneously came up with, but go back with that and then go mm-hmm. tweak. It's all about the tweaking. Yeah. Like Taj mm-hmm. Mahal, I was going to work with him. He go like, oh, here he comes with his tweezers.
That's a good impression.
Yeah. So I got tweezers, you know, I go in and I pick the lint off of it. I do the best I can to get it going, because there's no flash. It's not going to be flashy. It's going to be a call and response of the band, whatever instruments are on there between the mm-hmm. story. It's going to be a dance, you know, between mm-hmm. those things to deliver that message. So those songs like that, that are that old, I have to go back and fix them. And even with a new song, you have to fix it once you make the master recording that's going to go out and represent that song for the first time. Because you know what they say, you only get one chance to make a first impression, you know?
Yes.
And that song, if it makes an impression on the first time, well, that's your shot. Some of them I missed. I feel like I had some songs on my records that I kind of missed opportunities, you know, because of one reason or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But living in the moment, that song rose to the occasion. And Andrea Weltman was ecstatic.
It really does.
She's a librarian now.
Wow, that's amazing.
She's a kids, you know, librarian. And she said, yeah, I'm a librarian. We're old. She's an old lady. I'm an old man. And the song comes out. That's kind of exciting. You know, I had another moment with the song. Quiet Moments. You know, that song on the Oklahoma album, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Oklahoma, it was on Oklahoma, was it? Yeah. Quiet Moments, because Kristen Chenoweth did a part on it, and she's from Oklahoma, you know? It resonated with people from Oklahoma. The person I wrote that Oklahoma song with is from Oklahoma. And I was thinking about Oklahoma and my experience with it. Like visiting Oklahoma after a tornado was like, I'm from California. I've seen earthquakes. That tornado. Oh, buddy.
Yeah.
Man. It rips through there. So I talk about all the things about Oklahoma. I can feel the spirit lifting me up, taking me higher. I can never get enough. I thought about of Oklahoma, cowboys and Choctaws. You know, it's lines like, meet me at the rodeo, saddle me up. Then I made it on the bridge. I made a tribute to the Gap Band, which is an over on Greenwood, Archer, Pine. That's the Gap Band. There's an elevated state of mind. Keep on reaching for the sky, because when they go low, Michelle Obama, we go high in Oklahoma. So Oklahoma is the
okay, same. And you got the chance to meet Michelle Obama, right?
Yeah.
I feel like you've talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Does she smell amazing?
She's
quite. I have to imagine.
I don't know. She is quite. I didn't get that close, but she is. She is. If I was married to her, I'd be president.
Yes.
You know what I mean? She is.
Yes. No, she's the secret sauce.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. And when you get around them, you're sitting around them and Mr. Obama, President Obama, and you see the dynamic, you know where the power is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fun.
I want to talk about your song, They Don't Make Them Like They Used To, which is a really fun song on this album with Take Six.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of the collaboration that you did with Roseanne Cash, Put a Woman in Charge.
Yeah.
I feel like you have this theme of speaking about the power of women to potentially a male audience. Like, you need to pay attention and afford women the respect and, like, not assume you know, how women are supposed to behave and how they're supposed to treat you. Do you feel a sense of responsibility of like educating people and like telling men to evolve in their relationship with women?
No. Once again, I just tell the story.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this chronicle. Women in Charge is like way back when, in the beginning of time, man made the fire, then the wheel went from a horse to an automobile and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm. It's not about having an agenda. It's just like telling the story as it is.
After all being said, let's put a woman in charge. you know, how about that? The idea didn't really resonate when it first came out. It was like, what you talking about? But it started to resonate, you know, and I think it keeps resonating. And the men, there were certain places, but I watch the people's faces. I think men get a little uncomfortable sometimes, you know. Do you know what you're saying there, young man? Well, not a young man, but you know, that look on there, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But don't make them like they used to. That's from the standpoint of grandma and grandpa. And I had to change some lyrics in it because the women went in an uproar. And there's one line in the song that I left it in just one time. And I probably have to apologize for it, you know, going forward. It's like, it says, they don't do what they're supposed to do. Yeah.
I like that line.
I like it too. Like it was grandma.
Because I think it's honest. It's like, you can't expect women to act how you think they're supposed to act. Like women are, the times are changing. Mm-hmm. Women are taking different liberties now. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. It's from the standpoint of grandma. The grandma's talking about this stuff. She said, you know, you better buckle up, buddy. Times have changed.
Love that song. Yeah. And speaking of the arrangements and like you have talked a lot about getting out of your own way and keeping things simple. And the arrangements on this album are very stripped down to an extent. How does your guitar playing change when you have Take Six entering the mix?
Well,
do you have to be conscious of not stepping on each other's toes?
No, the first thing I do is I sing with just me and the guitar. The Take Six idea is the afterthought. Yeah. It's the afterthought of, okay, how can we make this kick a little more? Because it starts sounding like a gospel quartet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They don't make this combined, you know? I smell biscuits, you know? And so I thought about it. I said, no, I could have called any bunch of guys to come in and do a gospel quartet thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And, but I thought a gospel sextet with Take Six.
That's another level.
With a little more panache to it. Not like the Dixie Hummingbirds or the Blind Boys. I called them and I caught them on the day that they were all in town in Nashville. And they did it. I was just mind blown. I mean, my mind's blown by Take Six. I mean, with all the stuff that they do. They're just amazing.
The math of how they arrange their songs is so amazing to me. I saw them do a Beach Boys tribute with Michael McDonald at the Dolby Theater, I think, out in LA.
Mm.
And I just feel like I'd never heard the Beach Boys quite that way because there was such an intricacy to the harmonies that you're hearing the whole band and orchestra just in their voices.
They're an instrument.
Yeah.
Take Six. They are one instrument. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's amazing. And it's such a great song. Let's talk about some of the other special guests that you had on this album. The Soweto Gospel Choir feature on Hand It Over. Did you feel like there needed to be a moment for faith and prayer on this record?
No. I didn't. I felt like it just happened. These albums make themselves. I don't make these albums. I just get out the way and let them rain down. They always tell you what they want. Once you get the songs and you put it together, the body of work starts to take on a life of its own, and it starts telling you what it wants. You know, they've been like so walking on water, Hand It Over, being right next to each other. That's a spiritual moment, yeah. And Walking on Water, that's a cover that I wrote with Jill Colucci and Rita Coolidge. Mm-hmm. And it's like, she did it on her album. So I asked Carl, you mind if I do it too? I think I'd like to do it too. She said, yeah, you know. So I just put it on there and I never know how they're going to fit. Sometimes I look at these records and when I look at it and the group of songs that I have, I go, my God, they don't fit together. They're all over the map, but they always do. They always fit.
Yeah. Maybe that comes down to the sequencing.
Yeah, the sequencing. Yeah, that's what I mean. It's absolutely the sequencing. You know, and so if you put honesty together, I think, and you don't worry about how it's going to come out. I don't know. It's just, It always works. Because I'm not that smart to really be able to put something. I mean, I'm not saying I'm dumb, but I'm not that smart where I can see that far in
front. To in advance to have a plan.
But when I just go with the way it's rolling down the hill, the way it's coming in, It always never let me down yet. And that's life too. How it's coming at me, how it's coming down the hill, how it's, you know, rolling. It's like.
I have a question about Stitched Up Heart. That feels like a level of vulnerability and personal writing, like even deeper than maybe other releases that you've had. Have you had the chance to perform that song live? Like, does it feel like you're singing about your own guts and body?
I haven't had a chance to perform it live. I probably only know how to play about 3 songs on the record. I got to go back and learn it.
You got time.
Yeah, I got time. So, but that song is the woman that was the lead surgeon on my, when I had heart surgery 2 years ago, she came in and, you know, and she was very thorough. She was a badass. She was on it, you know, and I immediately like knew I was going to be trusting this woman with my life, you know, and it's really a homage to her, you know, she walked into the room. It was love at first sight, not that kind of love, just, you know what I mean? She knew I
had. No, but a deeper love of deep trust.
Yeah, she knew I had a problem, only that she could make it right. Yeah, and so on and so on, you know? And then from there, and I'm talking about like the whole process, like even the insurance, I got a lot of it.
Yeah.
I'm feeling
your deductible, I think you mentioned on one of the verses.
I'm indestructible. I paid my deductible.
That is a really good lyric. It's so good. Because people sing about the heart all the time. It's like one of the most addressed topics in song. Mm-hmm. But writing about the process of actually getting your physical heart operated on and stitched up is another level for me.
I love writing this. I really came in. I was literally in recovery. I couldn't walk to the bathroom without, you know. And Rebecca Correa came over and said, "That's right." You know, then I said, I'm like, "Okay, all right." And we kicked out that song and I Stitched Up Heart. And just, that's about as honest as you get, you know. Mm-hmm. And, she gave me a magic potion, you know. I fell asleep in her loving arms. You know, I trusted her completely, you know, to keep me safe from harm. But while I was sleeping, she pulled out all her tools. Oh, they sawed my shit in half. And
there's nothing pretty about it.
Went in there and did who knows what. And I woke up to tell about it.
Thank goodness.
It's gratefulness. And what's in that is gratefulness, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is a deeper kind of love.
Yeah.
I found that, you know, coming back to your voice, I think your vocal performance on More Yesterdays tells its own whole story. I mean, in addition to the lyrics and the music and the production on that song, there's fragility meeting strength. You know, the mystery of the future meeting the certainty of the past. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what it felt like to write, perform, and record that song?
Okay, that's another oldie. That song's 15 years old. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, more like 18 years old. It was like, it was a co-write when I came to Nashville when I first moved here with Mark Beeson. And at the time we wrote it, I just put it aside. I just went, no. But I mean, like, I never forget certain songs. You never forget because I don't have so many songs that I'm going through like volumes and volumes of songs that I like.
Right.
I like to keep things simple. Like in the recording process now, you can keep everything you ever record and you can go through and you can like cut and paste and put things all together. And I go, no, 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 no. Yeah. Just don't record all of that. Just just a few, you know, because I don't want to have to go through all this stuff. Same with songwriting. I don't want to have to go through 100 songs to figure out what I like. So there's like 3 songs lurking in the that I haven't recorded. And then that song, I can really focus on them because every song was written about something. So, and sometimes the time just is not right. Like living in the moment, the time is right. More yesterdays, the time became right because I started, I felt the song. I was too young, even though I was approaching 60 when I wrote, you know, I was still too young to really, I felt pretty good. Yeah. When I was in my late 50s, I was feeling like 40, you know, I was kind of, you know, but, you know, so I didn't really, but after that, they cut my ass open. I was like, okay, now let's do that one. Let's throw that one in there, you know? So it all like.
It sounds like you have a really good intuition of when it's time because that song really hits home on right. this record in a way I can't imagine it landing on one of your previous albums.
No. Yeah. Give me I like the line, give me more ice, give me ice cream.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a party.
More cake, more ice cream. Yeah, come on.
Yeah, it's the simple things at this point.
Yeah.
I want to talk briefly about your relationship with hero-turned-collaborator and friend Taj Mahal. I have this old copy of Acoustic Guitar Magazine I was reading on the plane, mm-hmm. and you guys did an interview together where you said, "We are Taj Mahal and Keb Mo, but together we become a third entity." Can you speak mm-hmm. to that third thing? Who or what is it?
Well, it's a third thing. Yes, it's an entity, like a marriage. You know, there's mm-hmm. the husband, the wife, and then there's the marriage. And then there's 3 things operating, you know. So yeah. The partnership, there's 2 individuals. And what the 2 individuals create together is a thing. I just listened to some albums of Taj and listened to the Taj Mahal album. And the Taj Mahal mm-hmm. album is different from anything, what we do, you know, it's not the same thing.
Yes.
You know, because of, I mean, and me working with Taj Mahal is like something I thought I'd never get to do. And when I got there, I wasn't even like dreaming it, you know, you know, I was just kind of like, there's Taj Mahal. Yeah, he's cool, you know? And every time I play with him, like sometimes I've been on stage with him, he's, I'm kind of a little intimidated because he'll look like this and go, what you doing? you know, I mean, the first time I played with him, it was like,
you stay on your toes.
Yeah. You know, because he's on the lookout for, wankers, he calls them. Don't be a wanker. Watch out for these wankers.
If you guys wanted to do merch, a t-shirt that says "Don't be a wanker," I would buy it.
Yeah, and he trusted me. I came in mm-hmm. and I started working on. We started working on that first Taj Mahal record, mm-hmm. and he, you know what I mean? He said, "Okay, all right," you know, and I just, you know, just kind of drove the boat. But like, you know, I know at the same time while I'm driving the boat, I'm never going to get to fool of myself thinking I'm driving the boat because I'm not driving the boat. You know, I'm just a passenger, you know, mm-hmm. and that he is here listening to his music and what he did, what he the road that he laid down allowed me to be on the road that I'm on. So I can't sit there thinking I'm cute or something, you know? It's like, no, you just... And when he opens his mouth to sing, I go, yeah, that's what makes the whole thing really, you know, the difference, what we both bring to it. And it's the history. I first heard Taj Mahal at a high school assembly in 1969 at Compton High School. And so, you know, and I was like, okay, that's different. What was that? because it was like the blues, but not kind of like the blues my mom and my folks were listening to after church on Sunday. Mm-hmm. This was like some other kind of shit. Excuse me. Sorry.
Oh, that's fine.
You know what I mean? It was some other kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, and I always, I was always directed. I didn't start following him around, but I got I was gifted by a four-track cassette. It wasn't a cassette tape. It was before eight-track tapes, there were four-track mm-hmm. tapes that had a brief thing, and then they immediately upgraded to the eight-track tape that held more stuff. But a friend of mine, Robert Mims, you know, who I was going to school with, he bought this Taj Mahal album. He put it in his tape player in his car. He didn't like it. Mm-hmm. He said, "Hey, man, here, why don't you take that? I don't like this. You take this." I wore that tape. I wore that thing out. When he started painting that mailbox and, you know, and just talking about all that stuff, I was like, oh, my goodness. It was just like, yeah, it was just crazy. I was like, this is it right here.
Well, I know the two of you have tour dates coming up. Are there sonic territories that you still want to explore together? Like, is there uncharted stuff you still have left to accomplish as a duo?
Well, I never look at us as a... I looked at that first Taj Mahal album as a one thing, one time thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I've done it. So yeah. We did it. All right. Leave it alone.
Yeah.
Then here comes Concord Records. You guys think you want to do another one? Nah. We won't do another one.
Inquiring minds want to know.
Yeah. And they managed to convince us. You know. And so we did it. And it was fun again. So I think there's probably an infinite amount of ideas we could explore together. Mm-hmm. But I'm still wanting to explore some things in my own catalog that I've left behind that I haven't even like probably put in front of an audience, either never or as much as I should have, you know. So I'm still digging into my catalog, my past catalog, going, how can I fish some more out of here? And because making records, I kind of like, I don't know that anybody cares anymore about a new record.
I can speak for the basic folk corner of the world. Mm-hmm. It's still very exciting. I think this new record of yours is really moving. And I don't think people are ready or able to anticipate the feelings that they're going to feel when they hear the songs. You know, it's not even, yes, it's about your catalog, but it's also about how you as a performer keep evolving over time. So I'm grateful that you keep making new records.
Well, every time I'm making a new one, I'm scared. I'm just scared because I know I have to show up again, you know?
Mm.
And that's why I don't think I write all the time, because I don't want to exhaust my all of my ideas trying to write a whole bunch of songs. You know, I'd rather just mm-hmm. pick my battles. Let's write about that. let's write about that. And let's go in and let's get it though. You know what I mean? And then let's go play. Let's go out and play. Let's go have dinner. Let me go visit the family. Let's go. Let's get out of here. You know?
Yeah, that's what life is.
Yeah, you have to have some life to have some songs. So I don't know.
Now, success means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and especially as musicians. For some people, it's money, awards, this or that venue, being your own boss. What does success mean to you, Kevin? And do you think you've achieved it?
Depending on any day you ask me, you might get a slightly different answer. Mm-hmm. Today's answer is I still get to play and I don't have to get a straight job.
Hell yeah.
that's success. And everything above that to me is like more gravy. That's just dessert. But basically, I get to go play. I get to write songs. I get to perform them. I get to share my work with other people. You know, and mm-hmm. that's the thing. You know.
My last question for you before I do a little lightning round, if you're down, is what has love been teaching you lately?
Love has been teaching me that I'm kind of wimpy. Yeah, we're gonna go. I'm gonna reach back to early in our we touched on it with my temperament, is that I don't set boundaries. And I'm very easily offended. Not offended when you make me mad, but I'm literal, you know. I don't understand women. I don't always understand women because I'm just a literal. I'm simple. I'm a heavy-handed screwdriver. I'm simple. And like a kid, like, go. And so I take things literally, and I don't know the riddle of femininity, the riddle that goes on. I don't always understand it. What was the question again?
What has love been teaching you?
Oh, it's been teaching me to speak up and continue to pause and to listen deeper and to be, just, I don't know. Don't run so quick.
Those are good insights.
Yeah.
Okay. Time for the lightning round. Okay. For the lightning round, just answer quickly. Don't think too hard.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, go. Okay. What is your biggest pet peeve?
Somebody trying to punk me.
Not cool. What is your most useful non-musical skill?
My ability to stay calm. Yeah.
Yeah. Which do we prefer, sweet snacks or salty snacks?
Oh, sweet snacks.
What is your pre-show beverage?
Throat coat, a lozenge, fisherman's friend, and water.
You're a model citizen for singers. What is your favorite vacation destination?
I don't have one. I've gone on so few vacations that I don't know.
Okay, before we talk next, you owe yourself a vacation. Going home.
Going home. That's my favorite vacation.
Who is a great musician from California that everyone should know about?
Okay. They already know about him, like Greg Fillinganes.
Cool. What animal would you like to be reincarnated as in your next life?
An eagle.
Oh, that's a good one. I don't think any other guest has mentioned an eagle. And finally, what makes you hopeful?
What makes me hopeful is that I think there's always, in the midst of chaos, there's always something better coming. And I think we're on a cycle of chaos, clarity. And it loops around. That's what the One Day Away song sounds about. Like, there's something coming, but it's going to come back, you know, and life is problem solving. You know, that's, you know, one after the other. Problems are never going to go away. You're never going to have a life without problems. So just knowing that, just owning it and just being okay with it.
Acceptance.
Yeah. See, that's smart. You got that woman brain.
I'm just summarizing the stuff you just said.
Yeah.
That's my trick.
Yeah.
If I'm hearing you right, it's this thing. Thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. You are a legendary musician, and we're just so stoked to have you on the pod.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for taking your time. Yeah, thank you. This was a very, very nice interview. Very nice conversation. I call it a conversation.
Oh, thank you.
Very well put together. You asked me some brilliant questions, and thank you so much for, you know.
Thank you.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can find us on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can go to our website, basicfolk.com, or you can listen wherever you get your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, I recommend sharing it with a friend, someone who has a really hard and fast definition of the blues music. Have them take a listen to this and maybe that'll change their mind. All right, thanks for listening all the way to the end of Basic Folk 350. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.